Okay, so this is going to be a lightning review about positivity bounds and effective field theories. And if you don't know what those are about, it's basically looking at the implications of the combined set of unitarity, causality, and Lorentz invariants on putting constraints on effective field theories, but from making those assumptions about the UV completion. These will be the same assumptions that occur in the S matrix bootstrap, so in fact a lot of what I say will be cover both of those things, but I'll talk more about positivity bounds because that's what I've been working on. So the central question we're asking, and this will be something we discuss later in the day, is are all effective field theories consistent? And the modern perspective is the answer is no. I can write down a low energy effective field theory that looks superficially consistent in that it respects all the symmetries I would like. It's unitary, at least order by order in the EFT expansion. But it doesn't. But now we understand it doesn't necessarily descend from a consistent high energy completion. At least if you not if you make very specific assumptions about that UV completion. Specific but quite generic. And so the assumptions, as I say, are going to be that the UV completion is unitary, local, causal in some sense, and Lorentz or Poincaré invariant. And we'll see how from those assumptions you can derive very definite statements which go under the umbrella of positivity bounds or positivity constraints. We get the same similar statements in the S matrix bootstrap program. And these are essentially signs on the coefficients of the irrelevant operators, signs and magnitudes of the coefficients of the irrelevant operators that occur in the EFT expansion. And in fact, it's recently been understood that in fact, many of these bounds are really compact bounds, and so we find that the Wilson coefficients in the EFT expansion are constrained from both sides. And we'll see a little some examples of that later. So just to remind you, what I'm going to talk a lot about S matrix analyticity, and analyticity is a proxy for causality. That's the general understanding. And the initial motivation for that is you think about how it occurs in non-relativistic physics. So imagine some system which you can phrase in the language of its evolution in the language of a retarded propagator. So the retarded propagator only exists if T is in the future of T prime. That, of course, is basic non-relativistic causality. And if you Fourier transform that, the Fourier transform is analytic in the upper half complex plane. And so analyticity is understood to be directly associated with causality. Now, this was, of course, this was understood a long time ago, and it was incorporated into relativistic field theories in the 60s, and, well, 50s and 60s, I guess you could say. And so one crucial result that hinges on that, which hopefully you've all done in your quantum field theory classes, is the Chalin-Lehmann spectral representation. So that starts with the assumption we've got some, let's say, some scalar operator in a Lorentz invariant theory. Then causality and locality is the statement that the operators should commute if they're space-like separated. Unitarity, of course, is just that the if this is a real operator, if I square it, if I smooth it with some test function and square it, its expectation value should be positive. And from these assumptions, Lorentz invariance, causality in this form, and unitarity in that form, you can derive the famous Chalin-Lehmann spectral representation. Here I've written it as a statement about the time-ordered product of those two operators. And the statement is if you put that in momentous space, so you effectively look at what you think of as the fully interacting Feynman propagator in that theory, the structure of it has the form of potentially a pole describing the massive state you're looking at, and then some spectral integral where the coefficient in that spectral integral is manifestly positive by unitarity. There's some technical points. Normally when you do this in your intro field theory class, you don't include these bits. These are to do with so-called subtractions, and that occurs if the spectral density grows too fast, you have to do write down the dispersion relation with some subtractions. Minor technical point, but don't worry too much about that. But the key thing is unitarity is encoded in this positivity statement. And this is really a statement about the analytic structure. So if you remember, the Feynman propagator, of course, is really a function of k squared minus I epsilon, famous minus epsilon prescription. And there's a perspective on that that you just regard that as a complex variable, z. And the statement we're making is that the Feynman propagator is a function of that complex variable z, is an analytic function modulo a pole, which is where the physical mass is, and a branch cut, which starts at 4m squared. Of course, the branch cut occurs from loops. So it's about analyticity. And here already is an example where, to derive this result, we used relativistic locality, and that was crucial. And the consequence of relativistic locality is analyticity. So for the rest of this talk, analyticity is the proxy for causality. Now, when I make this statement about the analytic structure, that's a mathematical statement. That is the structure. Now, we heard from John about effective field theories. What they are is a description of low-energy physics. So this region here, below the cutoff, lambda, whatever that is for a particular theory, is the region in which the low-energy effective field theory is valid. But the analyticity statement is assumed to be true at all energy scales, if the UV completion is local, Lorentz invariant, and unitary. So we know that, so although we don't know what the UV completion of our given low-energy effective theory is, we do know its analytic structure, and we know, and in this region, we assume that we can calculate it. If somebody gives you a low-energy effective field theory, I can just do this calculation, calculate the two-point function, and then I can subtract this out, and then if I subtract it out, if I explicitly remove the pole and the low-energy branch cut, then I get an expression for the subtracted Feynman propagator, which now you expect to be an analytic function with a branch cut going from the cutoff out to infinity, and that means it admits a dispersion relation of this form. Okay, so far so good. Now, from that form, because the spectral density is positive, you can derive what are called positivity, a set of positivity bounds, which are just come from the fact that the moments of this spectral density are themselves positive. So if I take that subtracted Feynman propagator as a function of my complex variable, and I differentiate it enough times to remove this annoying subtraction polynomial, this is given by a set of integrals, and if I evaluate that at z is 0, so I'm just doing a Taylor expansion of the function in the region where the EFT is valid, I compute that Taylor expansion, it's given by a set of positive integrals. The spectral density is positive, and these are just positive moments where the weighting from the energy in that comes from the cutoff up to infinity. And so you can already easily see very simple linear bounds that you get from that. But you can also derive, this is just a classic maths problem, the moment problem, goes back to Stieltjes, or however you say his name, in the 1890s. You can also derive an infinite set of nonlinear bounds, which come from the fact that if you construct this particular combination of these quantities, then you can show that this quantity is positive. It's essentially a generalization of the Cauchy-Schwarz type inequality. And that implies that if you construct what's called a Hankel matrix, where this is a specific example, but Hankel matrix is a matrix whose you take each of those coefficients, and in the particular element of the matrix, if you sum the number, the row element and the column element, and you put the associated coefficient, which is comes from the sum of the row and the column element in there, then you can show that the determinant of that Hankel matrix is positive. So this is simpler to see in a particular example. If I take this coefficient here, construct this 2x2 matrix, d2n, d2m, and dn plus m, then it follows just from Cauchy-Schwarz that the determinant of this matrix is positive. And other moment relations you can derive, you can easily show that, in fact, that there's a universal bound on d2n given d1 and d0. And this just comes from the fact that it is these quantities have to come from the integral of a positive quantity. So these are moment positivity bounds. Now, what does this have to do in an EFT? Well, I'm here computing a two-point function, and we're saying that the various moments of this two-point function have to be positive. What do they have to do with EFT itself? Well, essentially, let's suppose our EFT was essentially just a free theory, a tree-level free theory, with an infinite set of irrelevant operators which come with higher derivatives. Then the associated tree-level Feynman propagator written in this language in terms of the complex variable z would just be the inverse of that effective operator. And what I'm instructed to do is remove the pole, which is 1 over z here, and perform a Taylor expansion. So I do it like that. And then the statement is that each of these coefficients has to be positive. And on top of that, if I construct Hankel matrices built out of these coefficients, the determinant of those Hankel matrices is positive. So concretely, you get simple statements like this coefficient. If we assume there's no subtractions in this dispersion, A1 has to be positive, A2 has to be bigger than A1 squared. Those are simple statements. But then you also get nonlinear statements that come from, for example, Cauchy-Schwarz. If you work that out, this implies this statement and other similar statements. So you get an infinite set of these bounds. And the point is that now we're putting bounds directly on the coefficients that existed in the effective field theory Lagrangian. So these are positivity constraints on the coefficients in the EFT Lagrangian. Now, this is not normally the way the positivity bounds are used, and the reason is technical, because we don't, a priori, we don't know the number of subtractions we need in the two-point function, but we do in the context of the S matrix, and so really most of the discussion is in the context of the S matrix, where it's also expected that the scattering amplitude has an analytic structure. And again, this goes back to sort of 1960s assumptions. What do we assume about the S matrix? Well, we want it to be unitary. That's a given. Locality is a statement about how fast the scattering amplitudes grow at high energy. So the simplest assumption is that they're polynomially bounded, which means that in any direction in the complex plane, they don't grow faster than a polynomial. A weaker assumption is what's called exponentially bounded, which is that they don't grow faster than a linear exponential. And causality, again, is an assumption about analyticity in the context of the famous Mandelstam variables. And again, to some extent, that can be proved, at least for particular slices in the Mandelstam plane. We'll assume Poincaré invariance, crossing symmetry. And in the 1960s, people were mainly interested in theories where all the states were massive, and so you assume there's a mass gap. And the consequence of that is you have something called the Foissart bound. Now, so the punchline of these assumptions about analyticity is that the scattering amplitude, which are A, S of T, which is a function of the Mandelstam variables S and T, so T is the momentum transfer, S is the center of mass energy squared. This has to be an analytic function of S at fixed real values of T, at least below 4m squared, which is when you start hitting a branch cut, up to poles and branch cuts that are expected on physical grounds. And you also get from unitarity, or at least in its weak form of positivity, the imaginary part of the partial wave coefficients have to be positive. You can derive from that a statement that the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude, all its T derivatives, that's T as the momentum transfer, have to be positive. And from those assumptions, you can derive a rigorous bound that the scattering amplitude for a massive theory of the mass gap is bounded by S squared, at least in this region. And that allows us to write a dispersion relation with two subtractions. Now, positivity constraints or positivity bounds were first considered in the 1970s, and there's various different things were done. A lot of it very similar to what people are doing now, although a lot of the focus was really more on the partial waves themselves. So you can start with the assumption that the individual partial waves, these are partial waves associated with the scattering amplitude, their imaginary parts are positive, and they're bounded by unitarity in some region. And I'll just give you a quick example that people use. So if you take the partial wave expansion, which is the scattering amplitude can be written as a sum of Legendre polynomials with partial wave coefficients, and you, let me just absorb this annoying square root into this quantity, then you can reconstruct the partial wave coefficients by performing the inverse Legendre transform of the scattering amplitude. And then there's a nice little representation, which is called the Foissart-Grieboeuf representation, which comes from the fact that you can, associated with the Legendre polynomial, it's a associated Q polynomial, which can be written as a dispersive integral. Now, if you take this expression and you use the dispersion relation you expect on analyticity grounds, then you can show that the partial wave coefficients themselves, at least for two even values for two upwards, can themselves be given by a dispersive integral of this form, in which the what's sitting inside here is this imaginary part of the scattering amplitude, which has to be positive because of unitarity. And then if you do a little bit maths trickery, let me skip over that, the details don't matter too much, you can rewrite an integral representation for the Qs and do a little similar trick to what we did before with the Hankel matrices and so on, you can prove that the partial wave coefficients, if you construct a Hankel matrix built out of the partial wave coefficients themselves, then the determinant of that has to be positive. So for example, if you take the sixth partial wave coefficient, L equals 6 times L equals 2, this has to be bigger than L equals 4 squared, at least in this particular region. So this is an example of a result that was derived in the 1970s to put constraints on the form of scattering amplitudes. Now, the modern positivity bounds, of course, in the 1970s, people weren't really thinking about in the mindset of effective field theories. So the main difference in the modern bounds is to restate those constraints as constraints on the effective field theory itself, where it's more directly useful. So they come from generalizing the Chalin-Lehmann. The scattering amplitude has the same analytic structure in the sense you expect a pole associated with the mass and a branch cut going from 4m squared up. But because of crossing symmetry, you get a mirror pole and a mirror branch cut going the other way. And that allows you to write a dispersion relation up to what are called two subtractions, and that comes from the Foisot bound or the Jean-Martin bound, the growth of the amplitude. You can write that the scattering amplitude has the form of a pole here plus a pole there. That's the U-channel pole. U is 4m squared minus s minus t if we're looking at the scattering of identical particles of the same mass. Plus then two dispersive integrals, one which comes from integrating around this branch cut and one which comes from integrating around that branch cut. And again, the key is that these imaginary parts, because of unitarity, are positive, and not only are they positive, all their t derivatives are positive. So they're not just positive in the forward limit, t equals zero, they're also positive for positive t. You can do the same trick as before. If you know your low-energy effective theory, I can compute this in the low-energy region, subtract it out, and then make a statement about the remaining part of the amplitude, which is fed by the UV completion, about which you know nothing a priori, but you do know it satisfies this analytic structure, and that feeds into this positivity statement. Something went wrong there. There's a crucial equation I'm missing. Just what happened there? Okay, so there's a great result you can derive. I guess it is this result. I don't know. I think this equation. So you can derive from that because the t derivatives of this are all positive, and this is positive for t positive. If you differentiate this with respect to s any number of times, and you evaluate at the crossing symmetric point. I guess it is this result. You can show that that's given by an integral where this is all positive, so this is manifestly positive, and then you can construct the Hankel matrix. That's what's missing. If you take this quantity, you construct the Hankel matrix from it, you can write down an infinite number of nonlinear positivity bounds from that statement. It was a great result if you could see it. So these are examples of positivity bounds. And in fact, although most of the work on this has been recent, you can actually go back to 1985 and see probably the most interesting application of this, which is in the context of the pion-type effective field theory Lagrangians, in fact, the one that John wrote down earlier. This is usually phrased in the simple example of a Goldstone model. So if you just take a scalar with a shift symmetry, the first leading term you get is d phi to the 4. As an irrelevant operator, because I'm imposing a shift symmetry, so I'm not allowing any operators without derivatives. And then the positivity bound is just this one. If I twice differentiate this with respect to S, which is enough to remove the subtraction coefficients, it's given by an integral which is positive. And so in this particular example, it just gives this coefficient C. And so you infer that that coefficient has to be positive. So this is the canonical example people always give of the positivity bound, which goes back to this nice paper in 1984. In fact, what these authors did is a more complicated model, which is the pion Lagrangian with these two terms here. And they didn't phrase it exactly this way, but in retrospect, what they're saying is that this coefficient has to be positive, and this coefficient has to be positive, which again, you just infer from that particular scattering amplitude. Now, 1985 is also the year of Back to the Future, so if we go back to the future and go to 2006, this argument was used in this famous paper by Adams et al. And what they noticed, although they've just reproduced the positivity bound that was in that earlier paper, but they connected this with the fact that what is, you could ask, what is, in the EFT terms, what is wrong with this EFT? Well, what is wrong with this EFT, if you choose C to be negative, is that you then can see that you construct background solutions which lie within the regime of validity of the EFT, but nevertheless give rise to superluminal propagation. So in other words, there was a low energy indicator that there was something wrong with this EFT. And this is not too much surprising because the positivity bound is derived from analyticity itself. And the motivation for analyticity was causality. The belief is that analyticity is the correct proxy for causality, at least in S matrix theory. And of course, we know that we can't have speed of light being bigger than one, at least not for a long time, otherwise we get negative time advances and so on, create all sorts of problems, back to the future type problems. And so this seems to be consistent. Just say this quickly, you can do all this for, I've phrased it for scattering amplitudes in the simple case of scalars of the same mass, but you can do it for all spin particles. The nicest way that makes crossing symmetry the easiest is to use something called the transversity formalism, which is where instead of working with ellipticity projected onto the direction of motion of particle, you look at the spin directed along the plane normal to the scattering, and then crossing becomes very simple in that representation, and you can derive a dispersion relation for generic scattering of spinning particles. It's a bit technical, don't need to worry too much about that. But this was used, a nice result going back to Chung and Raymond, 2016, was if you apply this to, say, the interacting spin two theories, aka massive gravity, you can, by scattering different polarizations, mixtures of polarizations of massive gravitons, you can infer compact bounds on the coefficients in the effective Lagrangian. So if you just do one polarization, all you get is something is positive. But if you do many different polarizations, sometimes those positivity statements amount to saying, well, one coefficient has to be bigger than something, but it also has to be less than something else, and then you can infer compact bounds. And more recently, it was recognized you can do the same for scalar theories if you input the full implications of crossing symmetry into the dispersion relation. So when we normally write down these so-called fixed T dispersion relations, they are manifestly SU crossing symmetric, but they're not manifestly ST crossing symmetric. So when you oppose that extra input of full crossing symmetry, so crossing symmetry itself is quite powerful, and this, of course, is famously used in the various bootstrap approaches, when you put the full implications of crossing symmetry, this imposes very non-trivial constraints on the partial wave coefficients that you couldn't infer just from simple analyticity alone. So for example, if you take the scattering amplitude in general dimensions, which you can decompose into the in general dimensions, it's the Gegenbauer polynomials that take the role of the Legendre polynomials. The imaginary part of these partial waves are a positive, same argument, but what you can derive, let me skip to here actually, what you can derive is if you impose crossing symmetry, say with respect to ST crossing, this imposes extremely non-trivial constraints on integrals over the partial wave coefficients, which of course are just these particular examples of moments, with the insertion of particular polynomials of the multipole moment associated with each partial wave. So non-trivial combinations of the partial wave coefficients for different values of Ls and different masses have to satisfy constraints, which are now being called null constraints, which are necessary to have full crossing symmetry. And when you put the consequence of these null constraints, it imposes bounds, upper and lower bounds. So you don't just get positivity statements, you get two-sided bounds that says particular coefficients in the effective action, particular Wilson coefficients have to be bounded both from above and below. So this notation is the twice S derivative of the amplitude T differentiated divided by the twice S differentiated value. And something went wrong, very wrong, didn't it? Okay, so you can put these constraints on particular theories, for example, a particular effective theory called the weakly broken Galilean, which is we take a Galilean effective theory and you slightly break the symmetry, for example, just by adding a mass term or by adding a defi to the 4 type operator. These theories are just ruled out by the positivity bounds because you can't have a small breaking, basically because the Galilean symmetry itself is in conflict, because you can't have a, because what the Galilean symmetry implies, this x here is s squared plus t squared plus u squared, that was in that equation box, and y is s to u, and these imply that this particular coefficient can't be vastly smaller than all the other coefficients, and that comes from these statements. Okay, quick comment, so it's now, so, don't know what's happening with my PDF, but it's now understood that in general you get compact bounds from all these various positivity statements on particular coefficients. So here's a particular example of an EFT where I have crucial coefficients are this is G12 and this is G8. You can't see it, I think. No, this is G10, sorry. And you get compact bounds on these coefficients. And you can also reproduce in part these bounds, just like in the Adams et al. Paper, you can reproduce in part these bounds from causality arguments by demanding that the scattering time delays around particular background solutions are positive. We've got quite close to reproducing those, although whilst these are precise statements, this is more murky because you have to check that your background is in the regime of validity of the EFT, which is a little bit harder to do. And now, I think in this conference, people are particularly interested in the question of what you do when you add gravity. Adding gravity into this story is a bit of a technical challenge. And the reason it's a technical challenge is that gravitons are massless, and they induce a pole in the scattering amplitude at t equals zero, whose residue goes like s squared. And that spoils one of the key assumptions, that the scattering amplitude is bounded by s squared at fixed t. And it also stops you going from the physical region, which of course is always t less than zero, to t positive. The partial wave expansion won't converge as you go across the boundary t bigger than zero. So most of the statements I've made so far relied on positivity at positive values of t, but that's the unphysical region. So we can't go from negative t to positive t because of the massless spin 2 pole. But now people have found ways around that, particularly this paper here. And what they showed is that even at negative t, which is the physical region, because t is minus p squared, t is the momentum transfer, it's really minus the momentum squared, you can find particular integrated quantities of the scattering amplitude derivatives in the negative t region, but you can still guarantee to be positive, and you can use that to put constraints on the coefficients. And in particular, this quantity C that occurs in the simple Goldstone mode, when you couple that to gravity, instead of just being strictly positive, it can actually be ever so slightly negative, where the amount of negativity is given by a ratio of what is the cutoff squared in the theory divided by the Planck scale squared. And that's a non-trivial example of how gravity slightly corrects positivity. And I think this is actually closely connected with what John was commenting about, how when you add gravity, you slightly change the light cone structure. This modifies precisely what you think is superluminal or not, and that feeds into this statement here. So this is a very analogous statement. And now this has been considered quite a lot. And for example, if you're given a generic EFT, the kind that we like to deal with, I've dropped the R squared terms here because they don't contribute to graviton scattering amplitudes. But if you look at graviton scattering amplitude in a theory with Einstein gravity plus R cubed and R to the 4 terms and parameterize these coefficients in a particular way, you can show that positivity bounds on the graviton scattering amplitudes, different polarizations of graviton scattering amplitudes coming from imposing crossing symmetry, et cetera, demand that those scattering amplitudes have to live in compact regions. And so that's the punchline. So positivity bounds there's been a lot of work recently, and they've been recognized as being very powerful at constraining low-energy effective theories, in particular when you put this extra input of crossing symmetry. And this is also used in the bootstrap-type approaches. And they're very powerful at putting constraints on certain classes of effective theories, for example, theories with extra symmetries or theories of massive spin fields. And with some assumptions, we can now apply them to gravitational theories. And the result is that the coefficients in the EFT Lagrangian basically fit with what you would have always expected based on power counting or naturalness arguments. So essentially, all the coefficients are constrained to be something of order one in terms of the cutoff, which of course is what you would always have said by kind of power counting or natural arguments, but now it's actually been proven if you take the assumptions of the positivity bounds. And so I'll leave it there.
Is it possible to say anything in the gravitational case relating the cutoff to M Planck?
So when you run this argument, you just assume there's some scale at which the EFT breaks down, which is basically where the beginning of the branch cut is. But it says nothing about what that scale is.
It doesn't say anything about where
it is. And it won't do. It never would do.
Right, thanks.
Yeah.
Very simple from somebody who understands half of what you say. One is this. Do I have to understand that in the low energy regime, listening to your talk after John this morning, the effective field theory that John's right in the low energy satisfies all your bounds?
Yes,
or
that's right.
One should expect. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So if you take his expression for the amplitudes and you if you take the magic part, it'll satisfy unitarity by ordering the expansion.
It does. So,
So the strength of these statements comes from not demanding that the EFT satisfies them, because it automatically does. It comes from demanding the UV theory satisfies them, and that feeds back through the analyticity, which is very non-trivial, into non-trivial constraints.
So the second half of the question is this. How much the hypothesis of all this depend on locality in actual the strong sense of local quantum field theory? The question is comes from somebody who is low quantum gravity. If you expect that at the Planck scale there is a you're just going out from the assumptions of local field theory, would you expect this bound to be broken or not?
Good. So I tell you exactly where it could potentially break. So there's two inputs of locality, relativistic locality. So one is in analyticity itself, which is really where causality is being imposed. But the second one is, if you go back to assumptions earlier on, it's about the growth of the scattering amplitudes. Now, we don't expect in a gravitational theory the scattering amplitudes to be polynomially bounded, and it's questionable even if they're bounded by linear exponentials. And this, in the old school 1960s stuff, this was needed as the input into to derive the Poisson bound and to derive the overall growth of the scattering amplitude. So that's needed in this input. Now, in modern approaches, you basically argue there's arguments that you still expect this in a gravitational theory at fixed t. You still expect the scattering amplitude to grow less than s squared at fixed t, but outside of that, if you don't just work at fixed t, it's not necessarily clear. So this is where locality comes in. It's about the growth of the scattering amplitude. And that's where things could possibly get messed up. And you can give explicit examples of non-local theories where this is certainly violated, and that would be the hole in the argument.
Yes, please.
Just to sharpen that last question up, suppose it wasn't, so you have a UV completion, which is full quantum gravity. And imagine that you have long distance effects, which are exponentially suppressed, but they allow, say it's a wormhole or something, they allow some object to teleport essentially very long distances. So it's a low energy effect, but it violates some of the assumptions, I think, that you're making. So how would that appear in this analytic
treatment? I'm not sure how that shows up in a 2-2 scattering amplitude, I guess. So, I mean, I think anything that would be argued as non-local in a 2-2 scattering amplitude just comes about in the growth of the scattering amplitude at large k, or perhaps a more dangerous violation of analyticity.
Yeah, I think in this case it would be something with an extremely small coefficient, but maybe violate some of these.
Yeah, so you can always imagine maybe these are violated by some non-perturbative but extremely suppressed contribution.
Okay, let us thank Andrew. Remember that there will be a discussion this afternoon, so I'll keep the rest of the questions. So thanks, Andrew, again.